Well, what do you know?
Channel 4 today. Anybody see it?
Here in Los Angeles? They did a special little report on the Pope's bank. Bishop Marcinkus. His connections to underworld figures who either hanged themselves or were shot. They showed a rare photo, the only photo they say has ever been taken inside the Vatican Bank. And commented that it's the most secret bank in the world. What happened and what Marcinkus has done brought great embarrassment to the Pope. But he's still in the Vatican. And the chances of getting the Pope or the Vatican to talk about the bank or Marcinkus, as they call him, is about as remote as the Pope sitting down and having lunch with you on the Avenue Veneto. Thank God somebody's finally listening. However, they finally got around at least one station to pointing out that there are some seamy sides to the Pope's domain. And they did it rather critically. Got handed to them. Now we got one exception among the hundreds of thousands of news stations in America. I had one of my staff members call, said, call and commend them for listening to me. However, they're doing it differently than I do. They're doing it in a negative way. I'm not against the Pope. I understand why they do not disclose. The essence of financial power is secrecy. And I understand why they won't release Marcinkus. And the Italian Supreme Court agreed. Same reason the Supreme Court turned Miranda loose. One, murderer running loose is not as dangerous to the American public as compromising the Constitution. And the Catholic Church, if I were heading it, I wouldn't give up any of the rights and freedoms that the Lateran Treaty gave me either. I'm not against the Pope. I'm for the Catholics. Paper today was commenting how many millions it's going to cost the city, including barrels filled with water as barricades for the Pope to come here. Everyone misunderstands what I'm saying if you think I am against what the Catholics are doing, pouring out their adulation for the Pope, against the Pope's lifestyle. I don't care how many palaces he has. He has plenty. I envy their art collection. Wish I had it. I'm not against the Pope. What I'm against is the news media and the United States government not giving the same respect and recognition of rights to every other religious faith. That's the point. I want to keep hammering it over and over and over again. This country has and is established upon a separation of church and state.
Government is not to establish a religion, nor is it to interfere with the free exercise thereof. This society, by its nature, is pluralistic. Even the governmental system is pluralistic. It's based upon a balance of powers that compete. We're watching the legislative branch struggle against any preemptions of power on the part of the executive branch. And the judicial branch, for too long, has been assuming to itself a dominant role. It's only an equal among three. It is the interpreter of the Constitution. It is not the legislative branch of government, as they sometimes try to make themselves and rewrite the laws in their own image. The judicial branch, black robes and lifetime tenure notwithstanding, are not the supreme power of this land. It was a mistake to ever call it the Supreme Court. The word supreme never should have been used in anything, because it creates the illusion that it's the top and the other two are somehow fighting it out underneath them. This country was based upon a recognition of human sin, self-seeking as the natural tendency of man, and the only adequate balance, or the only adequate way to prevent a totalitarian government emerging, is to balance power among conflicting centers. Now, since the government cannot interfere with religion, freedom of religion guaranteed that no one religion would dominate if all had equal chance. It created an arena for pluralism. The answer to the Catholic Church's power is not government restriction. Just leave the alternatives alone. Let the TV evangelists have free swing. If the Catholics don't like it, let them get on TV like Fulton J. Sheen did and preach. And what I'm objecting to is the pluralism is being thrown out of balance by a news media uniformly anti against any strong leadership other than the Catholics. And a tendency of all government agencies to ride herd on every religious group that attains any power of any kind while they hands off the Catholics. I think every religion ought to have the freedom to let its own gift make room for it. Now, on Fox Network, well, at least Channel 4 was recognizing there's a story there about the Vatican Bank. Fox Network really knocked a home run on their little special program that's an attempt to somehow compete with 2020 or otherwise. They had an inarticulate nonentity. They couldn't even keep the earplug in his ear. That was suddenly placed on a major network because he scribbled out, and based on the way he talked, he could use my dog to write for him, and it would have been more articulate. Former bodyguard of PTL, and such marvelously profound primetime questions as, did you find Tammy Baker attractive? Well, I'm a man. Yes, I did. I mean, after about four or five us, he made the profound revelation he was a man. Well, I thought she was an attractive woman. Uh-huh. Yes, I did. He must have had x-ray eyes.
First man ever to see her under the makeup. Well, did you like Jimmy Carter confess to Playboy, just lust after her? Now, doesn't that really make your day to listen to an interview like that? Well, yes, I'm a normal man. Well, why did you leave him? There were several reasons. Was it the way they ran PTO? Well, I think everybody recognized they did some good. Was it their lifestyle? Yeah, that was it. That was part of it. See, the real revelation of character is none of these people who come to their senses, so to speak, and feel that it's terrible, the lifestyle that Jim and Tammy Baker had. I don't think that's the thing I find to fault Jim and Tammy Baker about. What I find to fault them is they fled the flock. Shepherd dies for his sheep. I don't care if he dies in a Cadillac or a Ford. He dies for his flock. But what always amazes me is these people who leave because, quote, their conscience hurts them about the lifestyle, never offer to refund their salary while they work there. I mean, people go out and buy houses. I'm quite sure that if their conscience was that smitten, why don't they just spend the rest of their life paying their salary back with interest? I mean, when you come in as a bodyguard and you ride in a limousine the first day you go to work, there's got to be something real wrong with the conscience that takes several years to have feeling. I mean, what'd they do? Take the job in a deep freeze? I don't care, really, about the lifestyle. I've had it with this nincompoop mentality. What the world wants is the church to only reach the people they've made poor so they can assuage their own guilt for having made them poor. They'd love to have every church take care of all the starving poor while they continue to rip them off with the confidence the church will take care of them. My Bible teaches me that God's building up a kingdom of rulers, joint heirs with Christ, who rule and reign with Him throughout eternity. I've said for years, the church would be better off if every man that was a pastor or a preacher had the capacity to head General Motors, the creativity of a Howard Hughes, the financial skills of a Fred Volcker, and capable of being the President of the United States, except it'd be a step down. I always admired the old man over at the Worldwide Church of God. He got in a Gulfstream and flew to talk to heads of state. And I admire the Catholic Church. They believe that they are the sole depository of truth on this earth. And the guardians of that truth, preparing people for eternity. And if that premise is not true, and they know it's not true and don't believe it, then they're the hypocrites par excellence. I happen to believe they believe it. I don't think they are, but they believe they are. And once you take that premise, any other kind of behavior than the kind they are taking would be inconsistent with their position. Their position is very clear. The members of the Catholic Church owe their first and primary loyalty to the Church, because the Church, headed by Christ's vicar on earth, have the keys to the kingdom. Now, earthly governments will send you to prison and shoot you for being a traitor. Earthly governments, for their survival, will draft you and send you to the front lines to kill and be killed. Earthly governments engage in clandestine activities for their existence and survival, and use lies and deceits to accomplish that purpose. Earthly governments, for their survival, must accumulate capital, the instrument of power on this earth, and must be secretive in the holding and use of it. And the Catholic Church believes they are the earthly representative of the kingdom which is eternal. And they claim an allegiance from their people higher than the state. And with 500 million adherents worldwide, and a leader who is deemed infallible, they are a power to be reckoned with, and they don't have to bow and scrape, nor do they have to prove anything to the world looking at them, that by their largesse, namely the Catholic Church's largesse, can determine eternal life for you. You better worry about being on their good side if their claims are true, rather than the other way around. And they are perfectly consistent with their faith. And if one of their members abuses his position as the head of their bank, there is no higher authority than them. They can discipline on earth and control, in the terms of the response of the one they're disciplining, his destiny in eternity, whether he burns or skips on golden streets. So why should they let some piker newsman inquire about their behavior? Why should they let some outside earthly power inquire about the way they're handling the affair? There is no intermediary between them and God. They are the intermediary between all mankind and God. And they must work it out between themselves and God, since there's nobody in between and anyone else is beneath them. So why should they demean that purposeful existence? And why should they suggest by behavior that their claims are false by taking their problem into an inferior tribunal? Least of all the news media. So I'm all for the Catholics. I disagree with their premise. I think they're dead wrong. That's why I think the world needs an alternative. Like me and others. With the power of truth and the turning on of lights to set people free from that kind of control. But I respect their consistency with their position. There is no power on earth equal to the Pope in their view. It doesn't matter whether he has banks or armies. This life is preparation for the next life, and he holds the keys to the one eternal. There is no power above him on this earth. Only God is above him. And he is God's vicar. What do you think every residence that he goes to, temporary, is deemed a foreign embassy? Wouldn't some smart asteroid California attorney like to drum up a spurious lawsuit, serve papers on the Pope, establish jurisdiction, and depose him? They can no more do that than they can intrude into the Russian embassy. Wherever he lands, he writes terms of his travel. I'm all on his side. I'm just not willing to sit around and let fluffhead news people with neither the historic perspective nor the philosophic understanding fawn on the Pope as if he somehow, because of the size of the Catholic Church, deserves this and other religious leaders don't. Either don't fawn on any of them, including the Pope, or pass the fawning around a little bit. I don't agree with the Worldwide Church of God that Herbert W. Armstrong was God's apostle for this day up to his death. But I was the first to fight for their right to believe it. An old dumb jerk, clandestinely appointed receiver of that church, would stop me from sitting here on the air and sending a contribution to him down in Tucson when they dared to say that the people of that church couldn't communicate directly with their pastor general. Now, when you spell it out the way I've spelled it out these 25 minutes, you say that about any religious leader in the world but the Pope, and every news station in town would be mocking. The reason I hate Jim Baker is he's a wimp. I hate him. God, I hate him a lot. He should have stood up tall, said, "What I did is between me and God, and he and I have worked it out. And my lifestyle is my business. And if you don't like it, up yours." And stayed right there doing his job. And if the people who supported him didn't like it, they could stop supporting. I didn't like it. Not his lifestyle. That's the best thing about him, I thought, you know. At least he's doing something a little different than the rest of the crowd. I didn't like the way he raised money. I didn't like his whining ways. I didn't like his wife's vibrato. But he should have stayed right there and fought it out. I'm tired of the church apologizing. My Bible says that if you forsake father, mother, wife, children, houses, land, you'll have not only in this life, or not only in the life to come, but in this life also, many times those things. That applies to preachers. It applies to Christians. It applies to anybody who meets the test. And where did this idea come from that a preacher must set his lifestyle at the water level of the most poverty-stricken member of his church, usually that never paid tithe in their life? Now, I don't need to defend myself. What I am is obvious to the world. Always has been. I'm just having a field day mocking the press. I don't like their inconsistency. Now, I'm going to tell you a lot more tonight. The Catholic Church got a few skeletons in its closet. One day, sometime in the 18th century, the attention of a certain Frenchman, François-Marie de Arouet, was directed to a case which first shook a town, then France, and finally Europe. The murder of Jean Calais, a Protestant merchant of Toulouse. The Catholic Church had accused Calais of hanging one of his sons to prevent his becoming a Catholic. Calais was arrested. The civil magistrates on ecclesiastical orders condemned the old man to the rack, to be broken alive upon the wheel, and then be burned to ashes. This decree was executed on March 9th, 1762. Now let me tell you what follows. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
One day, sometime in the 18th century, the attention of a certain Frenchman, François-Marie de Arouet, was directed to a case which first shook a town, then shook France, finally shook Europe. The murder of Jean Calas, a Protestant merchant of Toulouse. The Catholic Church had accused Calas of hanging one of his sons to prevent his becoming a Catholic. Calas was arrested, and the civil magistrates on ecclesiastical orders condemned the old man to the rack, to be broken alive upon the wheel, and then to be burned to ashes. This decree was executed on March 9th, 1762. F.M. d'Arouet dedicated the best part of 3 years to proving Calas's complete innocence, which he did. Simultaneously, he swore to wage relentless war against a church which was capable of such murderous intolerance. His one-man campaign eventually contributed, perhaps more than any other, to the overthrow of Catholic encroachment upon civil authority in France, and indeed in most of Europe in the decades to come. His other name, Voltaire. One day also in the same century, a certain Roger Williams, while passing through Springfield Green in the North American colonies, saw a youth of 14 being burned at the stake by the civil magistrates, again under the orders of a church, only in this case the Church of England. Roger Williams swore to fight to the utmost the Protestant Church, which had enjoined civil authority to enforce her religious tyranny. Voltaire in Europe and Roger Williams in America, by openly revolting against Catholic and Protestant intolerance, had personified the will of the old and new worlds to get rid of all ecclesiastical encroachment upon civil authority. 200 years later, almost to the day, the Catholic Church's fathers, more than 2,500 of them, abbots, bishops, archbishops, cardinals, primates, patriarchs, and the Pope himself, congregated at the Second Vatican Council, where they advocated reunion, unity, and even, quote, religious liberty. Shortly before, the ecclesiastical head of the Church of England preceded by Queen Elizabeth II had visited the Vatican. The first time an Archbishop of Canterbury had done so since 1395. Following this ecclesiastical head of the Church of England visiting the Vatican, Calvinists went, Lutherans went, and other Protestant leaders. Catholics, who up to only a few decades earlier had branded all Protestant and Orthodox apostates, schismatics, and heretics, now address them as our dear separated brethren, as the Pope is now referring to the Jew as his dear elder brothers in the faith. While the Protestants now call the former Romanists, Papists, and idolatrous image worshippers, quote, our beloved brothers in Christ. The most active champion of organized Christianity had radically changed, it was said. The Catholic Church at last had turned into a vigorous advocate of the basic tenets of freedom of conscience, of thought, of speech, and of the right of the individual to believe, to think, and to say whatever he liked. It was truly a portent worthy of a cry. For were not these the same churches which only 8 generations before had tortured and burned at the stake an innocent old gentleman in France and a tender 14-year-old youth in North America? Indeed they were. Had they then transformed themselves so radically as to be practically no longer the same institutions? Indeed they had not. The spirit which had animated them 1,000 or barely 200 years earlier was still within them, as alive, as potent, and as aggressive as ever. The Protestant Reformation, when still a monolith, was as ruthlessly terroristic as its alma mater, the Catholic Church, which went on happily burning Protestants until 1781. Most of the original inhabitants of the North American colonies were religious refugees terrorized by the churches of Scotland and of England, which never hesitated to persecute, imprison, or hang whenever they had a chance. Witness Peter Annett, English writer, died 1769, imprisoned for attacking the authenticity of the Pentateuch, first 5 books of the Bible. Or Thomas Aitkenhead, an Edinburgh student, who having referred to the Old Testament as Isaiah's fables, was hanged for blasphemy in 1696 at the age of 18. Boy, would they have pilloried me. Turn the lights down. In Europe, torture was still enforced by all the tribunals of the Holy Inquisition until the last century, the Pope having been forced to abolish it as recently as 1816. Not boring you. It was only when established Protestantism fragmented itself into 1,001 conflicting denominations and fighting TV evangelists that its intolerance, having weakened, its power was greatly reduced. Since then, the bulk of its members have not only accepted but advocated contemporary liberties. Witness the flourishing, multifaceted Protestantism of the United States and its evangelical movements. Because of this, most of the Protestant denominations hailing freedom may be accepted as a genuine contributory factor to the basic democratic principles of modern man. Their acceptance of the Vatican's call to unity, however, is a different matter, since it jeopardizes not so much their present but their future existence. Their eagerness to unite is nothing more nor less than the most concrete demonstration of their monumental ignorance of the true aims of the Catholic Church, or it is a deliberate attempt on their part, following some incurable attack of ecclesiastical amnesia, at collective self-extinction. Follow that? They have acted with the same lack of prudence, the Protestants, that is, as those rabbit squirrels and mice of the field who, having suddenly heard the lion roar, "Brethren, let's unite," promptly persuaded themselves that the new recruit, the lion, had miraculously developed a taste for grass. For the astonishing facts are that the Catholic Church, unlike disintegrating established Protestantism, the Catholic Church is expanding in size, prestige, and power. All the Protestant preachers in America could come to Los Angeles and wouldn't cause the to-do that the Pope is causing. Above all, the Catholic Church is more than ever resolved to fulfill her magnitudinous ambition for the subjugation of anyone outside herself. And that's very consistent with their faith. To do otherwise would be to, in action, pose a question to the truth of their position. The pursuit of such ambition, subject everyone outside herself, is being carried out not in secret but in the open. 500. Now, when I finish tonight, the true picture of the Catholic Church, which I admire, will emerge a little more. I admire them. I say to you, if you're going to be a Christian, be one, man. Or don't mess with it at all. If the Catholic position is true, they can do and be no other. I'd have no respect for them at all if they acted differently. I just want the opportunity to turn lights on to people that are constantly under this worldwide attack. I want the freedom to offer them an alternative. And the Catholic Church is proof, absolute proof. You don't have to ride around the Model T and wear tattered denims. Now look, the Pope's robes are pretty fancy, but he doesn't have to wear those silk pants underneath. I've done my research. Those silk pants underneath would feed an orphan. Why doesn't he wear a bikini? Or go like kilts with nothing? The robe's long enough, man. Who cares? Who's going to sneak over and lift the Pope's robe? Save a little money. I'm telling you, penny pinching is not the criteria of success in the religious world. Most successful church in the world. This proves that stupid theory. What the world is telling the Protestants is how to lose. And you dumb stoops that buy it, the world would be better off if you'd just be passed away tonight sometime, go to your reward. The church on the defensive is losing. The Catholic Church is winning because it has a plan, it's on the offense. The Catholic Church, in the pursuit of its ambition, is carrying it out not in secret but in the open. 550 million beings, cemented by one single faith, organized by one single super efficient machinery, and led by one single leader, are on the march. If there's any one thing the success of the Catholic Church proves, is congregational polity doesn't work. Hierarchical dictatorial authority is the way to get it done. Hence, the world and the devil and the news media that's their instrument doesn't want a Protestant church to emulate the Catholic method. The general public of America is a bunch of brainwashed fools on the subject of religion. The Catholic Church's numerical strength, intercontinental administration, global diplomatic network, political dominance, and intangible pressure are all being blatantly used to that end. Subject anyone outside herself. Whence comes such an inflexible Catholic determination to conquer? Hey, I'm just reporting. I'm not criticizing. I just want the opportunity for other religions to be allowed with a favorable review to express themselves. Which comes their inflexible determination to conquer? It comes from her unshakable belief that she has been divinely commissioned to destroy error. And since truth can be found only within herself, Protestantism, Orthodoxy, and other Christian and non-Christian religions can find salvation only within her. For reunion, in her parlance, signifies only one thing: the return to the fold of all those who are separated from her. And this semantical massage about the Jews being our elder brother simply means, as God chose Jacob over Esau, the younger one, and Ephraim over Manasseh, Manasseh being the older and Ephraim the younger, so has God chosen the church over its elder brother. And we recognize you as our elder brother in order that we might have dialogue, so you will recognize the birthright we have. Now you made your contribution. We'll love you. You can even share in our inheritance if you recognize our birthright is supreme. That's why he invited them to his palace, sat in a separated chair, the very nature of which was to testify with building language as well as body language. He was granting them an audience. Big deal. All this ecumenicity is about as reminds me of the cannibal that ate a Baptist missionary, a Catholic missionary, and a Pentecostal missionary. When that cannibal finished that feast, he had an ecumenical movement. That's not all. The societies where such separated religions have flourished must follow suit, since truth must prevail. not only in the religious, but in the moral, ethical, sociological, political, and economic fields, contemporary society being the sum of them all, which implies that the Catholic Church must see that truth, her truth, prevails simultaneously within and outside herself. And this has always been, still is, and will always be her most basic tenet. It follows that she is bound to pursue a policy directed at the ultimate fulfillment of such an aim. They have this duty. The intermediary, the bearers of the keys of the kingdom, the depository of truth, who, when they think on a subject, are thinking as God, and the Pope, when he speaks from that frame, is infallible. All other truthful expressions are fallible and relative to that. None of the news media is stopping to think. It is that viewpoint. Not a single Protestant that I know, at their worst, not a television evangelist in America. Even Jimmy Swaggart, with his stupidity, doesn't go that far. Not a one of them ever tried to make their followers believe they're infallible. They do their own, sometimes good, sometimes not so good, most of the time bad, attempts to justify their position by an objective criteria of their exegesis of God's Word, the inerrant Word of God. At the very least, they offer an inerrant Word of God, which is checkable by their congregation. Only the Catholic Church is headed by an infallible claim to be, and accepted to be, under threat of excommunication, to even question. Infallible leader. And that's what the news media is fawning over. The infallible communicator of truth is coming to town. I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, the Constitution of the United States gives the right to every Catholic to believe that and to get happiness from following it. And I'll fight for their right to do it, including, if it's true and he holds the keys to the kingdom and you live in a barrio and you've got a cup full of pennies you got from begging, you couldn't spend it better than to give it to the Pope if his claim is true. And to those who believe it, I'll fight for their right to invest in that belief. That's what this country's about. What I'm angry about is the mockery and the disdain and the contempt and the attempt to change and the disallowance of the right of Protestants and other religious faiths to express themselves similarly for a much less threatening claim by their leaders. That's my quarrel, and I'm going to keep quarreling about it. As society is in a continuous flux, the Catholic Church, while immutable in her basic tenets, cannot remain so in her policies. Hence, her adoption of a strategy characterized by flexibility of approach, ruthless discarding of antiquated methods, and swift implementation of new ones in harmony with the mood of the novel times. This has been one of her most fundamental principles throughout her long history. Thus, after her total paramountcy in the Middle Ages had induced in her a chronic spiritual lassitude which ignited the Reformation, she fought back with the Counter-Reformation following the pattern described above. She counterattacked not only with the formidable dogmatic and physical coercion of the past, but with an entirely new weapon, a vigorous army of spiritual stormtroopers, the Jesuits and cognate orders, created for the specific purpose of undermining and capturing the theological, cultural, and intellectual citadels of the newly born Protestant Europe. But although the new strategy characterized the colorful diplomatic intrigues and attempted assassinations, the summoning of maritime might, for example, the Spanish Armada, reinforced by a relentless intellectual war upon the novel mores of Europe, succeeded in containing the rising Protestant tide, it failed to stop the advance of the new mood, the generator of the two greatest cataclysms of the 18th century. In the New World, the North American Revolution, with its heretical principle of separation of church and state. In the Old World, the French Revolution. The ancient Catholic fabric disintegrated into shreds. In the Western Hemisphere, with the loss of the Spanish Empire of Central and South America. In Europe, with the crashing of the ancient clerico-dynastic establishment. Since then, having reassembled her forces, the Catholic Church has cleverly modified her basic grand strategy, the better to confront the 19th and 20th centuries with the successful adoption of three interdependent principles summarized as follows. 1. Supporting any military, economic, or political force interested in the retention of the status quo so as to crush her contemporary paramount religious or ideological opponent. 2. Mobilizing all her religious, diplomatic, and political might to counterattack against such opponent in the event of failure to crush it. And 3. Which is where we are now. Forming an alliance with it, characterized by her joining it and in special circumstances leading it or even jumping ahead of it, should it hallmark the age with the application of its tenet. The aims of her seeming surrender being to slow down, capture and paralyze the enemy in order by ensuring ultimate control from within to stop its advance and ensure her own final advancement. The 19th century gave some brilliant demonstration of the successful application of these strategies. During its first decade, the Catholic Church inspired, blessed, and supported the dynastic military and political right-wing forces of Europe to destroy the dangerous ideology of liberalism. Then upon the collapse of the right-wing forces, she attacked the liberal heresy with all the religious, diplomatic, and political weapons of her armory. Liberalism and all that it stood for were anathematized. The Syllabus of Modern Error, issued in 1864 by Pope Pius IX, solemnly condemned freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of the press, democracy, and the like. Catholics were forbidden to sympathize with, join, or support any political party or government advocating or inspired by such anti-Christian liberal monstrosities as freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of press, democracy, and the like, under pain of sin, excommunication, and damnation. When that didn't work, you want me to continue? You know, Jesus said, when you pray, go in your closet, pray in secret. That's in Matthew chapter 6. Don't be like the Pharisees who pray on the street corner to be seen of men, but go in your closet and pray to your Father in secret, who rewards you. His vicar thinks the whole world's a closet. Pope John Paul II, Pilgrim of Peace. Well, as I said last night, Jesus said, when you go somewhere and you're invited as a guest, don't seek the high room, but seek the low room. Here he is in Mexico. You notice the coat of arms? The coat of arms. You see the keys to the kingdom? See what sits right over the keys to the kingdom? The Vatican. So much for Mexico. He travels humbly. And I need to point that out. Welcoming ceremony at Santo Domingo Airport. Poland. I'll tell you when to take a picture. He's praying in secret again. Take a picture. See all these people with cameras over here? Got to record that secret moment. Now he's praying in Ireland. You say he did this last night. I know. I'm not stupid. Now he's praying in Ireland. At least we know one cameraman was watching. Or else that's a miracle picture. I want you to notice that in the United States, they managed to take the picture at an angle that he towers above the Capitol. Very subtle. Hand it to them, folks. Man, they're consistent. I give them an A+. If I believe what they teach, I'd be struggling. There ain't anything I wouldn't pay if I had it to kiss his hand. I just don't believe their position. So I think God, I can hang on to that money. Here he is preaching to the skyscrapers in New York. The poor of the United States, he says, and of the world are your brothers and sisters in Christ. You must take of your substance and not just of your abundance in order to help them. Well, he could take his silk pants off and under the robe and probably clothe a couple of orphans with it. Only chance they'd ever have to wear silk. You see, I don't believe he should do that. I'm just pointing out the fallacy of the news media. They take that approach with all Protestants and other faiths. I'll tell you when to take a picture. Turkey. The Pope of the West meets the Metropolitan of the East. This coming together, this philosophy of reunion. Orthodox Church and Roman Catholic Church. It is already agreed by the Orthodox Church they will recognize the primacy of the Pope, they just won't recognize his supremacy. Why then doesn't the Catholic Church reunite, in fact, with the Orthodox Church and say, we willingly accept that only God is supreme. We thank you for giving us primacy of honor, and we don't want to be supreme. Because the Catholic Church believes it is supreme. And the unwillingness of the Orthodox to accept supremacy rather than simple primacy is what keeps them apart. But the Pope is sure they will ultimately recognize the error of their ways and grant supremacy. A major concession on that hilltop in Brazil. They do let the statue of Christ tower higher. Are you being cynical? No, reportorial. I'm not done yet. I'll be done in a minute. Relax. England. The Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury join in an ecumenical ceremony. But they refuse to have communion together. Until the Anglican Church returns to the Mother, they can't partake of communion together. And on it goes. Protestants think it's a big deal to be given an audience with the Pope. Having failed to stop the revolutionary burst of liberalism, the revolution in North America, and the French Revolution on the continent, they begin the second interdependent principle in their portfolio of attack, which, to go back to it, mobilizes all her religious, diplomatic, and political might to counterattack. Liberalism and all that it stood for were anathematized. As we move into the 1800s following the great revolutions here and in France, the Syllabus of Modern Errors, issued in 1864 by Pope Pius IX, solemnly condemned freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of the press, democracy, and the like. Six years later, the Pope will be declared an official council, infallible. The news media and its fawning on the Pope are fawning on the representative of an office declared infallible that in 1864 condemned solemnly in a Syllabus of Modern Errors freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of the press, democracy, and the like. Never ever heard a TV evangelist do anything like that. Would seem to me that an infallible condemnation of freedom of speech, freedom of worship, and freedom of the press is worse than having a little shady affair in a motel in Florida. Catholics were forbidden to sympathize with, join, or support any political party or government advocating or inspired by such anti-Christian liberal monstrosities as freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of press, democracy, and the like, under pain of sin, excommunication, and damnation. When her military and political allies finally tumbled altogether and the very papal states, including Rome, were wrenched from their control, the Pope tried to give liberalism a last mortal blow. The First Vatican Council was summoned, a dogma meant to strike at the very essence of the liberal ideology with its advocacy of reason, free inquiry, and liberty. A dogma against that was proclaimed. The Catholic Church put herself above all human reason and declared her head infallible. That was the answer to liberalism that the liberal press chooses now to ignore. Notwithstanding that, liberalism was soon to transform the whole of Europe into a political reality with which nothing could stop or even less destroy. Having realized this, that they had failed to stop liberalism, the Catholic Church then made a sudden somersault. Third plan goes in motion. What was the third plan? Form an alliance with the opponent, characterized by joining it and in special circumstances leading it or even jumping ahead of it. The aims of this seeming surrender being to slow down, capture, and paralyze the enemy in order, by ensuring ultimate control from within, to stop its advance and ensure her own final advancement. So the Catholic Church set in motion this third stage of her grand master plan and joined the irresistible liberal tide. the super reactionary Pius IX, writer of the Syllabus of Modern Errors, the inspirer of infallibility, and the excommunicator of the liberal revolution and all it stood for, was succeeded by a new pope, Leo XIII. Leo not only came to terms with the triumphant ideology, he supported it within the church itself. Indeed, he jumped ahead of it by making the Catholic Church the spearhead of embryonic socialism. And soon the Catholic and non-Catholic masses were given a magnificent social Magna Carta, Leo's epic-making encyclical Rerum Novarum. The world applauded. The Catholic Church had become the inspirer of all progressive forces. Long live the Catholic Church, the latest and greatest grand champion of human liberty. Result. Within a few decades, the Catholic Church was heading a super-conservative Europe, that same Europe which, formed by reactionary principalities, kingdoms, and empires, was eventually to plunge mankind into World War I. Following its collapse as a result of the first global conflict, the Catholic Church found herself face to face with an even more dangerous ideology than the one she had fought in the previous century, Bolshevism. Once more, her master strategy was set in motion. The first phase, like that of the second decade of the preceding century, was characterized by her inspiring and supporting all secular reactionary forces who were afraid of the Red Scourge as she was herself. Instead of the dynasties, landed classes, and super-conservatism characteristic of the 19th century, she now supported capitalism, supranationalism, and their direct offspring, fascism, the characteristic reactionary forces against communism in the early 20th century. These reactionary forces, after having successfully destroyed Bolshevism at home, ignited World War II and launched their military might against Soviet Russia. But Bolshevism emerged from the Holocaust ideologically and territorially stronger than before. The Catholic Church promptly joined a new vigorous anti-Red Crusader, the United States of America. Thereupon, while American atomic citadels were being erected around Soviet Russia, the Church accelerated a parallel encirclement via the methodological coordination of all the religious, political, and ideological weapons at her disposal. So the second phase of the strategy was set in motion. Attack. The result was that while the United States embarked upon a colossal rearmament program prompted and imitated by Soviet Russia, the Catholic Church joined the new anti-Red Crusade, armed with a resurrected and belligerent political Catholicism. Within a few years, Christian democracy, as the latter was named, political Catholicism, became the dominant political force of Europe, which it soon dominated with undisputed authority. But if the Catholic Church had successfully prevented communism from seizing power, she had not, as with liberalism in the previous century, managed to destroy its ideology. Witness Italy, which, although dominated by successive Catholic governments, harbored the largest communist party in the West outside of Russia. Christian democracy, which had prevented communism from capturing political power, had failed to uproot it from the heart of the masses. The Vatican, therefore, came openly to the fore. Catholics who supported communism were excommunicated. Millions were forced to vote as the Vatican dictated, to keep anti-communists, that is, Catholic governments, in power. To strengthen its campaign, the Vatican channeled religious emotionalism to its anti-Red Crusade. The sinister cult of Fatima, based upon the destruction and the ultimate conversion of Red Russia, supplanted Lourdes, until then the main religious shrine up to that point of Catholicism. Finally, Pope Pius XII promulgated another dogma, the bodily assumption of the Virgin Mary into heaven. But communism had become a global presence, with two red monster superpowers, Soviet Russia and Communist China. In addition, the world at large was subtly but irresistibly inching toward an undisguised form of leftism. While Europe and even the United States had embarked upon a degree of socialization, the Catholic Church herself had been infected. The workers' priest movement was ruthlessly suppressed. Cardinals suspected of sympathy with it were promptly exiled. Simultaneously, Asia and Africa become decolonized. Self-determination, freedom of the individual, of nations, of races, and of religious beliefs became the hallmark of the mid-20th century. As the 60s approached with world communism and established colossal presence in Eastern Europe, Russia, and China, democratic theory and practice, the accepted basis of world democracy, and the drifting of most Christian churches towards Christian unity, the policy of the Catholic Church was becoming, again, outdated. And so it came to pass that upon the disappearance of the most reactionary of her contemporary architects, Pope Pius XII in 1958, she embarked with startling suddenness again on the third phase of her grand strategy. If you can't whip them, join them. As in the previous century, when the super-conservative Pius IX was succeeded by the liberal Leo XIII, so now Pius XII, the supporter of fascism, an originator of the Cold War, the launcher of anathemas against anything Bolshevik, was succeeded by Pope John XIII, the Red Pope, the advocate of understanding with communism, with Protestantism, and even with the non-Christian religions, in 1962. The Second Vatican Council was convened to forge an image of the Catholic Church more in tune with the times. Liturgical modifications, ecclesiastical reforms, novel interpretations of dogmas, and a new approach to seemingly intractable problems became the key to her miraculous resurgence. In the ideological field, her policy turned into one of cooperation with the red foe. And in the religious area, she advocated ecumenism, reunion, dialogues, and unity. The Catholic Church had initiated the deployment of the third phase of her master strategy with boldness, energy, and the will to succeed. Once more, having lost a titanic battle against the main ideological forces of the century, she has suddenly jumped ahead of them in a brilliant endeavor to capture them from within. Her strategy was to slow down their impetus and steer them in her own direction, with the view of employing the very forces she wished to destroy for the final promotion of her own policy. As in the previous century, the world applauded. The Catholic Church had become progressive at last. Long live the Catholic Church, the latest and most energetic champion of human liberties. Result? Friends and foes, who only a while before had looked upon her with suspicious hostility, now rallied to her side to carry out her grand master plan. But verily, the Catholic Church is not changed. It is the world in which she is operating that has. And since she is the one and only true church, now perhaps even more than in antiquity, she is as irreformable as ever. Indeed, the more so tomorrow. She has determined to Catholicize a planet, stultified by the purposelessness of the mounting spiritual poverty of the contemporary teeming multitudes, busy glorifying themselves in their puniness. Am I boring you? You remember the story of the Trojan horse? If you can't whip him, you offer peace and give him a gift. A big horse. Oh, ain't it wonderful? We pull it inside. And when darkness settles in after the victory feast and people are slumbering, the citizens of Troy have gone to bed with the war over, they sneak out of the horse and open the gates, and Troy falls. Thus ended the famous city of Troy, which courted her own destruction by the gullibility of her inhabitants and the imprudence of her leaders. The Catholic Church's offer for reunion to all Christian churches is not in communion with her and of harmonious cooperation with the egalitarian-minded society of our age. It's a magnified ecclesiastical Trojan horse, a means to penetrate the citadels of other faiths and accomplish their capture and final capitulation. For how could an army whose existence is justified solely by its determination to subjugate all outside its ranks suddenly stultify itself by accepting the rights to liberty of all those who are not yet enrolled in its battalions? Obviously, a wise commander will consider whether the enemy's apparent change of heart has come about because he's been defeated by the city walls or because he's chosen a subtler form of warfare that gets him inside. The Trojan horse against Protestantism is reunion. Against contemporary world democracy, it is the unnatural Catholic advocacy of the theory and practice of liberty. Truth being the unique prerogative of the Catholic Church, a Protestant Christianity and a civil society not based upon it are ipso facto targets for the Catholic Church activities aimed at rendering whatever is not Catholic, Catholic. Thus, since the Catholic Church considers herself as the only repository of truth above both Protestantism and democracy, it follows that both Protestantism and democracy must ultimately conform to her teaching in all religious and civil matters. And that is never going to change. There is no Protestant preacher anywhere with such an agenda. But since religious teaching cannot be confined exclusively to religion, and by trespassing into the moral and ethical fields are converted into social, economic, and political dicta, it follows that the teaching church will claim her share in the principles and practice of both the religious and the civil administration of the society in which she's operating. For example, the Catholic Church, notwithstanding her latest concessions in the field, basically objects still to birth control, mostly on religious principles. These have created a moral problem which by its very nature is also an ethical one. You want me to keep going?
Yes,
this is pretty heavy. I'm getting back to the juicy stuff like in God's name, but I want to lay a foundation here. And since the ethics of the individual affect the society which he is a member of, the church's religious objection is automatically converted into a social issue. And since their position is the true one, they cannot change in the goal to make everybody conform. Let me continue.
Yes,
sir. I am reading from, and have been reading from, to you that just joined us, Catholic Power Today by Avril Manhattan, published by Lyle Stewart, New York. The Catholic Church of today is the Catholic Church of yesterday. And the Catholic Church of the past will be the Catholic Church of the future, as now she is of the present, because her ultimate aim is everlastingly the same, the subjugation of whatever is non-Catholic. Well, they don't do it with a whip in the liberal countries or with the Inquisition rack. But whatever the method, the goal's the same. Why? This aim, the subjugation of whatever is non-Catholic. Why? Because the Catholic Church claims to have the monopoly of divine truth. A monopoly owing to the fact that she is a teacher, this is a quote, incapable of error. That's the infallibility doctrine. She is a teacher incapable of error until the end of time. That's the way Pope Pius XI put it. Now, if one who represents that view can get the acclaim And favorable treatment can be accorded followers who believe in that. Why must Protestants be put on the defensive? You don't want me to continue. The Catholic Church of today, I'm reading from Catholic Power Today. By Avro Manhattan. The Catholic Church of today is the Catholic Church of yesterday, and the Catholic Church of the past will be the Catholic Church of the future. Because her ultimate aim never changes, the subjugation of whatever is not Catholic. Why? Because the Catholic Church claims to have the monopoly of divine truth. A monopoly owing to the fact that she is, quote, a teacher incapable of error until the end of time, as Pope Pius XI said. And that was after the Pope was declared infallible. So that statement's infallible. It is for the Catholic Church alone. Now, not all the Pope's statements are infallible. That's not their doctrine. But when he acts in his position as Vicar of Christ, he's infallible. And this statement by Pius XI was such a statement. It is for the Catholic Church alone, on that premise, to teach with a divine commission and by divine command that all human actions, whether of individuals or of states, must conform to God's laws, not only with regard to religious and moral problems, but with social and even economic ones. The Catholic Church is more than adamant about it, having the right and sacred duty to deal as an authority with social and economic problems, as another no less explicit papal injunction put it. To those not pertaining to her, outside the church that is, who might object to such a claim, the Pope states that society must conform with Catholic tenets since, quote, the deposit of truth entrusted to us by God in our weighty office of declaring, interpreting, and urging in season and out of season the entire moral law demand that both the social order and economic life be brought within our supreme jurisdiction. Well, yeah. Think of that. That's Pope Pius XI in 1931, long after infallibility was established. Moreover, said the Pope, as in all others where moral questions arise, the Church cannot forget or neglect its God-given mandate to watch and to teach, which includes the right of the Church to control education. Since, as the Pope put it, quote, to watch over the entire education of her children is the Catholic Church's inalienable right. Therefore, it is the duty of Catholics to see that the dicta of their church should rule society. They must influence the 500 million strong army carrying this out. They must influence all strata according to their abilities, calling, and intellectual, social, and economic status. Catholics must play their part not only in the business of municipal administration, but also in national politics. They've been doing this for years. It's only when a few Protestants decided to try to influence society that the news media got upset. For the Church declares, if Catholics hold aloof men whose principles offer but small guarantee for the welfare of the state, will the more readily seize the reins of government. When that occurs, the Pope says, laws which are not in harmony with those of the Catholic Church may be promulgated. In such a case, when laws, quote, are manifestly at variance with divine law, the Catholic should not hesitate as to which power to obey. He must consider himself a subject of the Church first and a subject of the state second. For as the Pope clearly states, quote, to withdraw allegiance from God in order to please man is a high crime. It is an act of consummate wickedness to disregard the rights of the Catholic Church under pretext of observing the law of the state. And should the state be obdurate and force the Catholics to obey its laws first, then, quote, to resist becomes a positive duty, says the Pope, and to obey a crime. So stated by infallible popes. In short, a Catholic should disregard, boycott, and fight the laws of the state to obey those of his church when the laws of the state are disapproved by the church. This is so because, continues the Pope, quoting, duties more numerous and of greater moment devolve on Catholics than on other citizens. For since Catholics are subjects of the church, the Pope says it is amongst their duties that they allow themselves to be ruled and directed by the authority and leadership of the bishops, and above all, the Apostolic See, which is the Pope. These are published views of the Pope, readily available for any newscaster in this city. When therefore the interests of the Catholic Church are threatened, quote, all differences of opinion among Catholics should cease, and irrespective of party, they must combine to defend religion, that is, the Catholic Church. Such an agenda sort of dims poor little Jim and Tammy's desire to build a Christian playground in the Carolinas.
For more of the teaching, please go to the next tape. Thank you.